Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, featuring inspiring stories from great Americans who are making a difference. Your host is West Point grad, former Army Ranger, and founder of Authentically American, Dean Wegner.
Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, featuring inspiring stories of great Americans who are making a difference. I'm your host, Dean Wegner, and I'm here today with my new friend and special guest, Scott Hamilton. Scott's story is truly inspirational. He is a four-time consecutive U.S. and world figure skating champion, and he won an Olympic gold medal in 1984. Scott is also a man of deep Christian faith, focused on being a great husband, father, and committed to making a difference in the lives of others. Scott, truly an honor to have you this morning, and thank you for joining us.
It's fun to get on. You know, I'm the new kid on the block. You know, authentically American. You know, so we love your products. My Cares Foundation uses and sells them. So yes. It's just a pleasure to be here with you and just have a great conversation.
Well, what I'd love to do, Scott, is allow our audience to get to know you on a more personal level. So go back very early on to your upbringing and how'd you get started in figure skating?
Well, you know, I am 60 years old, so this could be a long podcast. No, I was, sort of an unintended child by a unwed mother who probably had other options. So I consider the first miracle that I was ever born to be, you know, kind of like, thank you, Lord, for seeing that through. And then it was just, you know, being adopted at 6 weeks of age. Childhood illness kind of kept me in hospitals for 4 years. And then just to give my parents a morning off, they sent me to the rink just because there was a brand new facility at Bowling Green State University. And my health started to improve once I started skating more often. So skating became kind of the miracle cure that nobody ever intended it to be. And so those 4 years in hospitals where I never got a diagnosis became skating career where I just got better. And then I lost a lot and lost and failed tests. And I wasn't very good, but my health was getting better. And then I just sort of figured it out after I lost my mother to cancer. I knew that there was something more to this that I wasn't doing properly. And had a good run. Then I got cancer after I turned professional. I was in my 13th year of being pro. I was diagnosed with cancer about the 20th anniversary of losing my mother. And that was a profound episode of my life. It really woke me up to wanting to live my life more authentically and genuinely to, you know, what I was supposed to be doing. I didn't know that basically cancer was going to be just that fork in the road that I had to take, that, you know, it was basically God telling me, okay, all right, I've had it. We've had enough of you doing it your way. Now let's, let me reroute you and wake you up. And so the cancer was probably the greatest thing that's ever happened. Wow. And, it set me on a new path and to where I was able to get married, start a family and, you know, create new opportunities of giving back, and it's just been a miraculous journey. You know, and then you know the health problems of 2004, 2010, 2016 of a recurring brain tumor, which I found out I was born with, and that was the cause of my childhood illness that went undetected because they didn't have the technology back then to find it. So, you know, it's all been kind of a really kind of wild ride, miraculous journey. And you know, now my life is about serving my family and my community.
Yeah. You gave us 60 years.
I can be concise rarely, but you know, you asked for the overview and then we can do a deeper dive in anything you want to. Yeah.
So did you start out figure skating or was it just skating in general, hockey? Where'd you get
the skating? No, it was just learn to skate. And then, you know, the learn to skate coaches were all figure skating coaches.
Okay.
I didn't play hockey until probably year two or three of my skating life because I was just being mercilessly teased about being a figure skater. And so I played hockey. I did well. I joke, I played for three seasons. I figure skated and played hockey. I didn't just switch over. I did both because I was really better at figure skating. I joked that I played hockey for two neck braces, and then it was time for me to like move on. And so, I started playing hockey, I guess, when I was 10. Stopped when I was 12, and then it was just all figure skating. It was just all in. And by then, you know, I'd stopped the teasing because I played hockey and I did better than a lot of the people teasing me, you know. So, and then the figure skating thing just took on a life of its own.
Well, Scott, I was a hockey player growing up and still play today, and you had two neck braces. I've got two new front teeth.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing with hockey is, you know, like I part my hair in the middle, you part your teeth in the middle.
That's right.
You know, it's like you got to have a good dental plan to play hockey.
So what point was it early on when you said, you know what, I'm actually pretty good at this and I've got a future?
You know, when you're a boy, you get more success even when you're bad because there are less boys figure skating than there are girls. If you're a girl and you medal in a competition, that means you're really good. Yeah. If you're a boy and you don't medal in a competition, you probably need to start working harder or doing something else. Yeah. So
just not as many?
There's not as many, you know, and so... for me, you know, I do well locally, regionally, sectionally, spotty, you know, top three, whatever. Nationally, epic fail. You know, I get to the nationals. My first year on the novice men's level, the categories are the little guys are juvenile, then intermediate, then novice, then junior, then senior. Yeah. Those are the five categories. So as a novice competitor, my first year, I didn't get to the nationals. I was fourth. At the sectionals, which is the qualifier. And then the next year I made it and I came in dead last because I fell five times in my long program. So epic, like disaster. You know, you don't even fall that many times in practice. How do you fall that many times in front of 17,500 people? So the next year I went back and I was kind of next to last because I went straight to nationals next year because I qualified the year before at sectionals. I won sectionals. So I was able to go straight to nationals the next year, even though I was last the year before and I beat one guy, but he wasn't very good. and then I went up to the juniors thinking that the worst thing that could happen is I could come in last. Well, I'm used to that, you know, so I'll just go up to juniors and come in last. Who cares? started showing some signs of improvement, beat two guys. So I came in seventh out of nine. And then my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And then the next year, she just basically said, you know, we're broke. You have 1 year left in skating. You'll graduate from high school this year, and then we'll just do something else. You know, college would be good. My parents were both professors at the University of Bowling Green, so I would get in for free. I could be given free tuition. She said, "We can afford that, but we can't afford
free.
We can't afford skating after this year." And so
it's expensive.
I'm not killing it in skating, so who cares? You know. So that year, my regular coach had retired and a new coach took over, and he was kind of a crack the whipper kind of coach. And I figured I might as well submit because, you know, got nothing else to do after this year in skating. And so that year I kind of went all in and ended up winning junior nationals. And unexpectedly on my end, I realized that, you know, I was skating better and I just happened to throw it together on that week. You know, figuring I had nothing to lose, you know, just might as well. And won junior nationals, but people had anticipated a good result that year. And there's a lot of talk going around. And so caught the eye of a coach who had a sponsor in his hip pocket and said, "If you'll come take from me, I'll get your skating expenses paid for." And so
I afford that one too.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's like, you know, but when you step back, I was in all of it, you know, it's just always in all of it, you know. And so it's humbling, you know, just to figure that, you know, you're loved always, no matter what you do, you're loved. And and so I had to do my part and just sort of figure it out. So the first year of being sponsored and looked after, I turned 18, which is not a good year for all of that. failed epically. And that was the last time my mother ever saw me skate in competition. Oh, wow. So that haunts me and it makes me want to do better in pretty much everything I do. So, so I just got to work, from that ninth place finish at nationals. Nines are really, you know, kind of like the recurring, you know, pain point in my life. ninth again.
Top 10.
Yeah. From there. Yeah. 10. out of that, I just sort of, looked at life and looked at my identity differently. It was an awakening, and you know, another one of those painful awakenings. And I just decided that I wasn't going to be denied anymore. I wasn't going to deny myself, and I was just going to do whatever it took to be the skater and the person that she thought I could be.
Wow.
Now, I still made a mountain of mistakes, but the skating part of it was like I just put my head down and got to work.
Conviction.
Yeah. So, yeah, so from that ninth place finish where she saw me epically fail, next year I was third, made the world team, and came in 11th world championships.
Wow.
And then 2 years later I was on the Olympic team where I came in fifth of the world championships. And then after that, the top three guys all retired from competing, and so all I had to do was wake up, and I was ranked second in the world, which was kind of an odd deal. And then I figured, what do I have to do in order to win, because I'm this close, and it's right there, I can see it. What do I have to do to win? And it was, you know, figures. Compulsory figures. I hated them because they were boring and they were tedious and they were awful and it was just like torture to me. And then I realized that I was just hurting myself by not falling in love with the whole job. I just wanted to do the parts of the job that I liked. So I can relate to people in that way, because we all have jobs. There are certain things of our job that we hate doing, and we tend not to be as good at those parts of the job as we should be. But once I realized that I had to be good at the whole job and not just the parts that I liked, then I started figuring out ways of winning more consistently.
Yeah.
And so for the next 4 years, except for the first international competition where I showed up kind of freaked out and not quite gelled yet, a month later I was at another international competition in Canada. And from that competition on, I never lost another competition.
Wow.
So 4 years, I went 3.5 years without losing, which is, you know, and I don't say that for any other reason than I got lucky a lot. Some guys that should have beat me had sort of unfortunate falls at the end of programs, which left the door open for me to kind of get lucky. And then I realized after my second world championship that first world championship, I thought, either the sports is at its lowest place in history if I'm its world champion, or I got to get to work and be more worthy of the title. After I won the second time, I realized that I'm just competing against a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
You know, they're just guys. They're like me. They're guys. You know, they get up in the morning.
One leg at a time.
They all have their own strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. They all have their own confidences and insecurities, and they're just like me. I've gotten this far. How do I stay ahead of them for two more years? And strategically, I figured out how to do that. And then I was able to get through the next 2 years undefeated as well. And so it was a good run. And it took a lot of coaching. My coach was spectacular. Got me through all the athletic, all the political, and all the maturity challenges that I had. Yeah. And just navigated it all really well and allowed me to be prepared when I needed to be prepared.
I think everybody knows how it finished. You know, Olympic gold champion, gold medal in 1984.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit before. One thing that struck me, you said, fell down five times in one competition. And I remember my dad, his mantra was all about work ethic and perseverance. And his motto was, you know, if you fall down seven times, get up eight.
Yeah, that math never really made sense to me, because if you get up one more time than you fall, I don't know where that other get up came from.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, in writing Finish First, my latest book, I really want to encourage people to compete.
Yeah.
You know, just really look at competition as a good thing. And I realized, I just did basic math, you know, just to figure out, I fell 41,600 times minimum in my skating career. And when you fall down 41,600 times, that means you had to get up 41,600 times. And once you get used to getting up, it's amazing how failures don't mean as much as they used to. You know, I was talking to a couple of baseball players at Fried Hartman University recently, and they came up, and I go, what sport are you guys? They go, baseball. And I go, wow, you mean, if you guys only fail 2 out of 3 times, you're in the Hall of Fame.
That's right.
And it's like, yeah, I never thought of it that way, but yeah. But it's you know, we're human beings, you know, we fail all the time. And it's easy to hang on to those failures as toxic, disfiguring, scarring episodes that just prevent us from moving forward. And I really had to, you know, look at failure differently, because I would carry all those things around with me as well. And they make you kind of not move forward in confidence. And I had to re-identify and repurpose failure in order to really be able to, you know, kind of succeed.
Yeah.
And I was able to do that. And then that's part of the finish first, you know, philosophy. And, you know, how do you fail and get past the failures? It's like, well, it's easy if you look at failure as information. You know, it's like, if I epically fail at this podcast, I can learn from that. And I can know next time I go out, I'll go, okay, I'm going to not say this and maybe say a little more of that, you know? So it's always a work in progress. Yeah. You know, it's not just, this is, the failure means you end something and that's it. It's like, well, no, only if you quit. Mm-hmm. But quitting is an option. So you just sort of go, okay, what did I learn? And then move forward. Failure is information, purely feedback, nothing more. And an example of that was when my son started playing hockey. He's a hockey fanatic. And he started in the youth league, and he got out there, and he, you know, he figure skated for a while, and he was really funny. He was a showman, and he got out there and he got the crowd going. It was really fun to see him do that. But when he started playing hockey, just, he was like totally fish out of water. You know, how do I do this? And they got destroyed the first couple games, and he was not ready to be playing anywhere near that level. And he got in the car and he was really upset and almost crying. And he just said, I hate this. I hate losing like this. And it's like, well, let's break it down. Mm-hmm. And I go, what happened out there today? And he goes, well, every time I had the puck, they'd skate past me and they'd take it away. And I go, so what does that tell you? And he goes, I got to skate faster. Yeah. And I go, right, skate faster. What else? Well, they kept taking the puck away from me. I go, what does that tell you? And he goes, I got to work on my stick handling. Mm-hmm. And then once he said that, he got this little twinkle in his eye, and he goes, and I want to get my shot up in that corner of the net. You know, I want to be strong enough to shoot the puck up in the corner of the net where the goalie has, they can't get it. And I go, that's amazing. This is really powerful. I go, so Max, what would you have learned today if you won? And he just looked at me like, is that a trick question?
What do you mean?
I go, what would you have learned if you won today? And he looked at me and goes, nothing? I go, exactly. Mm-hmm. I go, this isn't a destination where you are right now. It's part of the journey. So let's, as part of the journey, let's grow and learn and get better. And, you know, if you want to be in the NHL, if that's your dream, let's make smaller dreams first. You know, let's do accomplishable goals, a lot of them, and then you'll really keep progressing. I go, but you know, are you ready for that now? He goes, no. I go, there you go. So are you still upset about winning, or are you motivated? I mean, are you still upset about losing, or are you motivated? And he said, let's go get on public session. Let's skate. And I go, there you go.
That's practice. That's hard work.
That's it. So you fall down, you get up, and you figure out, that hurt. Let's not do that again. Let's figure out a way to not fall down on that, whatever move that is or whatever that situation is, and move past it and get better and stronger. And so I was afforded the opportunity to repurpose failure and to learn from it and grow from it.
Let's talk about that shortly, but real quick on the, I guess, pursuing a dream, because I think you obviously have a lot of God-given talent. And I think anyone that's winning a gold
medal, I give him
all
the glory. I don't even know how to tie my shoes. Like, he helped me figure that one out, you know. But it's, you know, everyone, you know, they've estimated that 100 billion people have been born to this planet historically. Mm-hmm. And each one of them is unique.
Oh, yeah.
Every single person's unique. Mm-hmm. So we all have to find our giftings. We all have to figure out what we do naturally, what we do. You know, it's like, if I wanted to be in the NBA, guess what? Not going to happen. So, you know, we take stock, right?
Yeah.
Physically and mentally, emotionally, spiritually, where can I leverage all those identities toward a goal or towards a set of goals? And it's amazing, you know, just in that process, you know, what you can figure out. And there was a little girl when I did the Olympics in Korea this year for NBC. Mm-hmm. I got to be really good friends with a venue manager, and one of his staff was just really suffering he said, he was from South Korea. He said, our culture is being forced into obedience more than, you know, being able to create a culture. Mm-hmm. Like in America, you can be anything you want, you can do anything you want. There, it's more or less work for Samsung and do as you're told. Uh-huh. Don't step outside the box. Do not step outside of your lane, because it's not going to end well for you. So a lot of the kids now are growing up, you know, there without hope and with just being obedient. Yeah. And I gave my finished first talk to this staff, and it was, you know, we talked for about an hour, and this girl came up to me at the end, and it was exactly what Josh told me it would happen. And she said, I don't understand what you mean about purpose.
Wow.
Like, what is that? And I go, well, you have a set of skills where you can leverage those to reveal your purpose. Then once you know your purpose, you can start really working towards being really great at it. And she goes, and I could just see that she's been told this 1,000 times. She said, I'm not good at anything.
Oh, wow.
And my heart shattered.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, this little girl has been told that she's not good at anything. How many times? And so I go, well, let's break it down. I go, what do you like to do? What brings you joy? Mm-hmm. And she said, I like to read. And I go, well, last two books. What were the last two books you read? And she goes, I read Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre. And I go, you like the classics.
Yeah.
And she just stood up. She goes, I do. And I just paused for a second. I go, maybe you're an author. Mm-hmm. And her eyes, just that pop of recognition, you know, said, I could just tell that I just took her breath away for a second, you know, and it was really powerful for me, because it was like, I don't know where that came from. It just came out. And she didn't know how to respond. She's just like, whoa. I go, try that.
Yeah.
And she just got excited. It was like, I don't know how that happened or what, you know, any of that, how that came about, but it was something I'll never forget, because that girl was given permission in that moment to dream and to do something that she knew would make her happy.
And how old was she?
Oh, probably either a senior in high school or a freshman college age.
It'd be fun whether it's a year from now, 5 years from 10 now, world-renowned author.
Yeah, I'll go to her book signing. Yeah. But I mean, who knows? You know, if it's short stories, or if it's becoming a teacher of literature, or, I mean, it's in that skill set that you can do a million different things.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's like write children's books, write, you know, the next Atlas Shrugged, write, you know, books based on your interests, whatever they are, you know. And it's amazing, you know, if we, you know, just sit down and take stock of what we enjoy and what comes easy to us, how our purpose is revealed and how we can be successful at it.
I love the way you put it, because I think there's the dream, the purpose that's going to drive you and have that sense of purpose that's not there. And then there's stock of your inventory. You gave the NBA analogy.
Yeah.
But I think the third one, it was about the work that it takes. And I think a lot of times people don't realize, you know, how much work, commitment, dedication goes in.
See, I don't like work, commitment, dedication. Those are all kind of like, ew, who do that? Work, commitment, dedication. I like saying, really honestly, everything is just commitment and repetition.
Mm-hmm.
It's commitment and repetition. The more you commit to something and you repeat those things, you realize that, okay, that's easy for me now. I'll just up the game and I'll do that. And then that becomes easy. And then you do that and that becomes easy. And pretty soon you're a light year past where your beginning stages were. And now you have a skill set that's beyond anything you could have anticipated. And it was just through commitment and repetition.
Yeah.
Like this whole idea of hard work, sacrifice, discipline, you know, for people, you know, I use this example a lot in my finished first talk. Is there's a guy, I show a picture of a storage area. He keeps his drums in a storage area. He wants to be a musician in Nashville, the most competitive music market probably in the world. And he makes an appointment from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. every night where he sits in this storage area and he bangs on his drums. 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. And then on the weekends, he gives himself a little bit of break from work and just enjoy his friendships. He's not just eliminating everything and just going for this thing myopically and that nothing else exists. He's making an appointment for himself to be successful. And a lot of us are just so spontaneous, you know? Like, when I get really lost in things, it's like, yeah, sure, I can do that. I know I got deadlines, but yeah, we'll just go ahead and do that. And it's like, then you get so far behind, and then now all of a sudden you got this mountain of work that's overwhelming, and it's like, I can't. Now I'm in failure mode, right? Mm-hmm. So I just tell people, make an appointment for yourself. That nothing else exists except for that time. And you'll be shocked at through just that appointment, through that dedication. And dedication is a positive word. Okay. That commitment and the repetition of the steps that you need to be successful, things just come.
Yeah. And I should have clarified because, you know, I think to the outside view, you know, that work, that dedication may seem like daunting. But, you know, we've talked, both of our boys play hockey. So my 14-year-old son has a dream to play in the NHL. And my wife Kelly and I talk about dream makers. We want to do everything we can to make his dream come true. And similar to the talk with your son, we had talks about what it's going to take. And he will play 6 games in 1 weekend, Scott. And when he comes back home, the first thing he does, he's down in our basement shooting pucks.
Yeah.
And it's not work for him.
I just ordered a shooting pad because my son's going through sticks and tape like you wouldn't believe. So I got a really slick shooting pad where he can shoot into a net all day long if he wants, and he won't ruin his sticks. So that's it. I mean, it's amazing as kids, we'll do things 1,000 times. Well, just because it's fun. We just do things at the times, whether it be shooting a puck or throwing a baseball or, running around and just do whatever we like to do. We just do it because we just like to do it. Instinctually, we just like something, we'll do it 1,000 times. If we like to eat something, we'll eat it 1,000 times.
Right.
You know, it's just, but your son, like my youngest, he's all hockey. He wants to watch the Preds every game. He wants to do all these. And my oldest biological son has got a soccer ball on his foot 24/7. He'll be doing his homework, and he'll be going back and forth with the ball underneath the table, and he's rolling it with his foot. Like, he's got to have a ball on his foot all the time. And for him, it's not drudgery. It's just, he just loves it, and he's way more comfortable trying to balance the ball on his foot and dribble it and do things. Like, we have this tiny little tennis ball. We just got a puppy, and he's doing foot skills, trying to fake the puppy out, keep the ball away from it. The dog is just running itself ragged. And every time the ball gets the dog gets the ball, he goes, time to go back and do this again, you know. So repetition is fun. If you really like what you're doing, you won't mind doing it a lot.
An expensive trainer you have in your dog.
he's doing his job. Yeah.
So 2 more questions about the figure skating, because I want to explore a lot of what you're doing today. So give people a glimpse back when you were training for that gold medal. You know, what did a day look like for you?
I get to the rink. First Olympics, I was skating at the Philadelphia Skating Club, which is a social club as much as it is, you know, a training site. Mostly it's a social club. So I'd have to schedule myself around where, you know, the social aspects of the club, like the ice dance sessions and a lot of the other things that we're doing during the day. So I'd get up super early. Like, I'd be on the ice at 5:30 and I would skate till about 9 o'clock. And then I'd come back for 2 hours at night. There was a figure session and a freestyle session at night. So I would do that every day. Either I'd rest or do a little off ice, you know, between. And that's how I trained then. And then when I moved back to Denver, I would start skating at about 7 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. And I would go do compulsory figures for like 3.5 hours straight. And then I'd take a little bit of a break, and then I would get my freestyle skates on, and I would skate for about 1 hour 15 doing hard, like the long program stuff. Yeah. And then at night I go back and I do another 50-minute figures session, and then another 45-minute freestyle. And then during the day it was either off ice or relaxation, so my body was rested for the evening workout. And it was just, that was my existence. You know, I knew that you know, in order to be prepared and ready, there were certain benchmarks I needed to hit at certain times of the year. Knowing the field, I knew how I had to win. I knew how I had to, or how I, what I needed to do to win, and where the other guys were. And then through different competitions and things, there's, you know, the idea of, you know, you keep an eye on your competition. You know where they were in March at the World Championships, and everybody takes a tour after the World Championships. So you're all together, so you can keep an eye on what you're doing.
You know, scouting.
And then you see, oh, they're working on this jump. Oh, man, what am I going to do to counteract that? And then the summer is planning with picking music, getting choreography done, really just starting to get used to all the new ways of moving. And then you start competing again in the fall all the way through March. So it's the year is pretty predictable.
Yeah.
It just comes down to, you know, really trying to keep, be strategic and keep an eye on, you know, what your competition's doing.
Well, speaking of strategic and seeing what the competition is doing, you were credited with bringing athleticism into figure skating, and your signature move's got the backflip. How in the world?
Well,
when
you,
that ever
you know,
done?
It was, I was always frustrated, always, because I'd watch figure skating on TV when I was a little kid, and it was always where the women were athletes and the men were artists, and I just thought, well, that's okay. I mean, it's okay. It's just where I grew up and how I grew up, and my focus is like, it's great to have the artistic elements and to be able to be, because I loved an audience and I knew that I wanted to be an entertainer in the sport. I loved an audience reaction always.
Oh, yeah.
But I realized that, you know, I really didn't want to be looked upon as an artist purely when I skated. And so I really went after the athleticism. I wanted it to be, you know, I upped the game. I was doing triple lutz consistently before most other people were. And that now a triple lutz is like a throwaway jump, you know. But back then it was like I had it before the other guys.
Right.
And so I was able to kind of gain credibility in a way that is like I'm turning heads, right?
Yeah.
So it was just, you know, athleticism. How many jumps can I do in a program? How do I spread them out so that the program is balanced and done? Because it's hard to do the difficult jumps at the end of a program because your legs are kind of shot. They're not as quick as they were at the beginning of the program. And so building my programs athletically, but also making them interesting, not so much, you know, high art, but interesting, where I showed different textures of choreography, all while combining the athletic elements to it. And, you know, I would get positive things. You know, Dick Button was the commentator of the day, and he would say, I really like how he's spreading out all the elements and not just front-loading programs, but spreading them out evenly throughout the program shows, you know, great athleticism and difficulty. And then when I went toward my last 2 years of world and Olympic competition, I changed out I took a speed skating suit, which is really athletic.
Oh, yeah.
And I just made a figure skating suit. So it wasn't so much a costume as it really was performance attire.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I realized that, you know, I was in a conversation with Sports Illustrated. I go, why do you guys label us all artists? And he goes, well, look what you're wearing. And I was like, oh, okay, I got it. So I
fits the picture.
Yeah, my coach and I talked about how do I, in 25 years, look back on my competitive career and not cringe, you know, because, you know, we all look back on what we wore in high school and the hairstyles and all that stuff. And we kind of go, okay, that was the time. That was, how do I create something that's so athletic, unique, and timeless that I'm never going to be embarrassed looking back on it? And it was Don that reached out to Desant, who makes speed skating and skiing wear. And we met with them on an international competition in Japan. And met with them. They took my sizes. They made my first few practice outfits. And then my first two competitive outfits for the 83 World Championships. And it was like, what's he doing? Those are so, those are so uninteresting. But what was really cool about them was the fabric was like stretched in every direction you could possibly imagine. And it was weightless. So there was no I didn't have to carry anything around that I didn't need.
Yeah.
There was unlimited flexibility. There wasn't anything restricting movement. Mm-hmm. It was just like, you guys, you want to carry around all that junk? Go ahead.
I'm lean and mean,
and I'm carrying nothing. And it's funny. I still see those outfits are in my one of my Olympic long program outfit. It's for whatever reason, it's in my closet. And I was just redoing some things the other day, and I picked it up, and it's like, man, I remember how these things weigh nothing. And just the ease and the freedom I had from all that. And I felt like, whatever, I don't care what you guys think, this is smart. It breathes, it moves, and it weighs nothing. I got this. And I look back on those pictures now, and it's like the strategy worked. I'm not embarrassed looking back on that stuff because it's kind of timeless.
Fantastic.
The hair... That's another thing, but, you know, that's okay.
That's not so timeless.
No, it's a mullet. Yeah.
Got it. So let's shift gears. So obviously known for the figure skating, gold medals, all you accomplished there. It's unbelievable to go 4 years without being defeated. But today, I think, Scott, you're known more for giving back and wanting to make a difference. So when did that switch happen in you, or was there a gradual over time?
Well, you know, I didn't really answer in the last question, but the backflip came out of me turning pro and wanting to separate my professional career from my amateur career, because backflips were illegal in amateur competitions. So I knew that I wanted to have longevity. I knew that was key to everything, was longevity. And you know, I knew that I wanted to have a career, and I was willing to do anything and everything to build that. So I did. I if there wasn't enough crew people, I'd unload the trucks. If there was, you know, whatever press needed, I'd do it. If there was somebody I need meet and greet, I'd do that. If there were, you know, I'd skate at the top of my game. If I was hurt, I didn't care, I'd skate anyway. You know, there was all that stuff that came with building an audience. I had three heroes when I started my pro career, because I was a huge music fan. And I just told this to Scott Moyer, who's the Olympic ice dance champion. They won three Olympic golds and one silver. They're greatest of all time.
Yeah.
He's trying to build a tour, and he wanted to sit and ask me how to do it. And, you know, we were talking. I go, here are my heroes going into my professional life. Bruce Springsteen, because he took a long time to build his audience, and he built them dedicated. He built them loyal. The second one was Neil Diamond, because every time you see Neil Diamond live, he's sharing the joy for his craft with his audience, and it's just contagious, and that's how you tour for 50 years.
Yeah.
The third one was Robert Plant, the lead singer of Led Zeppelin, because when he started his solo career, he was bringing his audience along with him, but he was taking all kinds of artistic risks, and he was on an artistic adventure to kind of create something that was joyful for him, but also was it kept his audience interested. So those were my three role models growing up. And so I got all the way through my professional career, started a family. When I lost my mother to cancer, I started becoming a fundraiser. You know, back in the day, we do skating exhibitions to raise money for research. And then when I survived cancer, I became less of fundraiser, probably, well, as much an activist as a fundraiser, because I realized what was missing in the cancer community. And then, you know, so we built the CARES platform to serve patients and to make sure that they had everything they needed to best endure their adventure. And, you know, through information and, you know, socio-psychological support in our mentorship program, Fourth Angel. But the information side was chemocare.com, because I didn't know what chemotherapy was when I was going through it. So there was all kinds of things that needed to be created so patients wouldn't have to fly blind while they were doing what they were doing. And now, knowing that the promise of future of cancer treatment options is all unleashing our own immune system to train our immune system, our T cells, how to fight cancer. Our bodies created the cancer. It's not naive to say that our body should be the one to destroy the cancer. I mean, just logical. So we need to fund immunotherapy research. So for me to give back, I lost my mom to cancer. I survived. So that's a part of my identity that I'll never be able to discard, right? Mm-hmm. It's got to, I've got to build pathways of, you know, using whatever talents and whatever resource or whatever relationships I have to be able to raise money to fund research and the right research.
Yeah.
And then the other part of it is, you know, skating gave me everything I have. And so to give back by creating a unique business model that teaches kids how to skate, no matter what their ambitions are, whether it's hockey, figure skating, whatever it is, recreational skating. We just want to give people a safe, fun environment for them to come out and just, check that off their bucket list. I know how to skate, and it's great, and I love it, and it's fun. I do it all the time. It's really great to be able to give back on those. Oh, yeah. So, those are my 80% of my time is spent doing my CARES Foundation and the Skating Academy with the Nashville Predators. And both of those I do as a volunteer. I'll never take a penny out of them because I know that financial resource is important. And I've got enough, I hope. So where I can go off and I can do my books and my speaking and other things to be able to keep the home fires burning. But 80% of my time is just to serve the community as best as I possibly can.
So I just think back, tying figure skating to what I've heard your life's goal is right now. Back then, at an early age, if you had said, my goal is to win an Olympic gold medal.
Yeah, I would.
People would have said, what, are you crazy?
No, my mom would say, we're going to the Olympics. And it's like, tap the brakes, Mom. There's nothing about my skating life right now that would even hint at an Olympic run. But things just, come out of other things. It's like you don't go from A to Z. Mm-hmm. You go from A to B to C to D. And a lot of people, I heard Simon Sinek say, it's like, millennials right now are at a disadvantage. It's not their fault.
Yeah.
They see the peak of the mountain and you go, that's where I'm going to go. They just don't see the mountain.
One big step.
Yeah. It's like, that's me, but I don't know what it takes to get up there. And so it's, instant gratification, with all of our devices and with, everything's right there in the palm of our hand, literally. But it's like, there's other things that need, other muscles that need to be developed, both physically, spiritually, mentally, and emotionally, to be able to build yourself up over time in order to be the person that you're really meant to be. And it's not being, it's not just being over the top to say, I want to do this. It's never over the top. Dream big, dream crazy, go like dream. But understand that through all that, there's a process, there's steps that go with every accomplishing each goal and each dream. And it's just being willing to commit to those steps and be joyful in it. Then you'll be great. I've never worked a day in my life. That's the way I feel. It's like I put a lot of effort into some things and I've sweat a lot and I've gotten my heart rate up to about 185 in some of these shows that I've done. But to me, I was given an opportunity to do something that I thoroughly enjoyed. So it doesn't feel like work. You can call it work.
Doesn't feel like it though.
No, it doesn't feel like it. Nonprofit, that's work, right? Because where's the next dollar coming from? Where's the next miracle coming from? And you really got to roll up your sleeve and put the time in. And it just is, it's hard. It's difficult. It's challenging. It's all those things, and so much of it is out of your control. You're depending so much on others that feels a little bit more like, this is a lot. But at the same time, I heroes like Danny Thomas, who built St. Jude, he just said, there are givers and takers in the world. The takers eat better, but the givers sleep better, And I'd rather have a million people give me a dollar, for the curing cancer than one person give me a million. Now I'll take both, but it's how do you get the work done? How do you build a critical mass? How do you keep an organization going when it purely depends on philanthropy? And that's hard.
Let me ask two questions related to that, because speaking of dreaming big, I've heard you say now that your life's mission, it was to find a cure to cancer.
Yeah.
So How close or how far away have...
You know, there's so much out there that gives you hope that it's right. It's closer than we think. You know, they map the genome. They understand the human body and how it works and its building blocks and how they affect your health. They understand, you know, just the minute differences between this person and that person. They understand if this gene is turned off that you're more prone to this type of illness. We know just from, you know, how badly we've trashed our environment that a lot of those things are coming now. It's like the fact that they sued Monsanto for lymphoma and won the case is like, holy cow, we are causing this, you know, as a, as a society. We need to be aware of, you know, where we're at risk and where we're not, and then how best to treat it. So when I look at CAR T therapy for lymphoma now, CAR T is they take your T cells out, they train them, they program them. You know, they basically, I think you need a donor. You need a donor that is a match. It's almost like a bone marrow transplant, but you need a donor that's a really close match so they can take those T cells and now teach them to recognize a certain element of that cell type. And when it does, it's like it's so game over. You can see it on a scan. You can watch it on a scan, the cancer just melting and being attacked and eaten up by the immune system. So I know just through all these things that, you know, by being on the Moffitt board, Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, by seeing the work they do, by partnering with the V Foundation, by a lot of the grants that are being proposed, that everything is pointing towards unleashing our own immune system to defeat cancer. And once we do, it's game over. Now, there's a lot of different types of cells, types of cancer locations. Some are easier and some are tougher than others. It's just, again, it's just the immune system. We have, you know, it's a biological thing. Our body creates the cancer. Let's teach our bodies how to destroy it. And that's the silver bullet that'll end cancer forever. And I know that the funding is so far beneath the science. Like back when Nixon declared war on cancer, the funding pushed the science. The more funding you had, the more science we could create. But now the science is a light year away from the funding. And if we can close that gap just a little bit, more and more miracles become possible. And if you find a treatment for one cancer, you can't even do the math on how many lives that are saved. So right now, you know, like last year, we were able to fund a medulloblastoma cancer research project, and that now is showing promise for glioblastoma. And you think of glioblastoma, you know, it's like John McCain. You think of, you know, a lot of Ted Kennedy, all these people that we've known and are, you know, that glioblastoma is just taken them from us. And children, especially with glioblastoma or any of these brain cancers, it's just the only way to treat them is to bake their brains and bathing them in radiation. They have no chance. Like they may be cancer free, but their whole trajectory in life is now forever changed. So to be able to use our own bodies to destroy the cancer, to me, that's the only thing worth investing in.
What I'm hearing is a lot of encouragement, a lot of development that says, you know what, this may be a dream. It still may be 20, 30,000 falls away from that 41,000 on the journey.
Well, you don't want to fall that many times when you're a nonprofit because people stop believing you. So you have to be strategic. But it is. There's science out there that's worth investing in that is showing right now promise that they're on the right path. And then there's other science that people want to fund, and I don't fault them for funding it. The guy that invented Nike Air, Frank Rudy, amazing man, loved him to death. He was basically a rocket scientist that figured out how to keep gas in a confined space, right? He figured out Nike Air. Why is it that your party balloons wither and deflate in a day, but your shoes stay inflated forever? Why is it? Frank figured it out. But he also had this idea that cancer cells had an ionic property, that if you could find that ionic property and just flick the switch, you could destroy the cancer, right? And so the cancer center that I worked with for a very, very long time, they said, will you talk to Frank, because none of this holds water. It's like, it doesn't make sense. And I go, if Frank is wrong, this is research that never has to be done again. but what if Frank is right? And they're like, but none of this makes sense. So they were fighting Frank. And Frank was absolutely saying, I just feel really strongly about this. I want to invest in this research. And they kept pushing back. And he sent them an article that basically showed that ulcers come from bacteria. That was presented in the early 60s, and those doctors were laughed out of the medical industry because we all know that ulcers are caused by stress. Yeah. So when they proved that these guys in the 60s were right, that's the article that Frank sent back to the cancer center. And he goes,
go back to history.
Yeah. It's like, we don't always, we may feel like we have all the answers, but we need to go through all the steps in order to prove that we're right or wrong. Yeah. So I'm not big on funding research that, you know, won't show promise immediately because I'm trying to be smart with other people's money. But at the same time, there are those that want to invest in research. Let's just prove that we don't have to do that again. If it's a dead end, let's show that it's a dead end so we never have to invest in that again.
What I'm hearing is you'd said science is here, funding is here, so that's the gap. So those that want to support your mission, Scott, to find a cure for cancer, tell everybody how they can do that.
ScottCares.org. Mm-hmm. And it's real easy to remember, ScottCares.org, slash donate. If you just go on scottcares.org, you'll see a donate button right there, bam, right in front. So again, we're a small organization that's partnering with big organizations. We're a small organization that's really very careful with the money that's invested in us. And we're just trying to make a difference in our world and grow our foundation to be able to look after people and look after cancers in a way that's unique. We're not... So many cancer foundations are disease-specific. Mm-hmm. Susan G. Komen is breast cancer. You've got Live Strong with testicular cancer.
Right.
CapCure is prostate cancer. You know, we're not so much about where the cancer is. We're mostly, our whole identity is about how it's treated. And we're all about treat the cancer, spare the patient harm. The status quo right now, to me, is massively unacceptable. You've got radiation, which, it'll release its energy on the cancer and get rid of it. But it's also creating a lot of collateral damage because as the radiation comes into the body, it'll hit the cancer, but it'll continue on into the body until it runs out of energy, which creates collateral damage. You look at chemotherapy, it's basically poison. We figured out something that's going to kill these cancer cells. And yes, it'll kill a lot of healthy cells as well. And you may have a shorter lifespan and you may have issues later on due to the damage that's been done. But at least you're going to be cancer free. I'm here 21 years later because of chemotherapy and I can't wait to get rid of it. You know, we're all about treat the cancer, spare the patient harm. And it's also about elevating through awareness of proton therapy, which is a very precise form of radiation where it's not a pass-through radiation like an X-ray beam or a photon beam. It is a hydrogen proton that's separated from the molecule, right? Spun at 2/3 the speed of light, and it stops directly where they want it to stop. So when it releases its energy, there's a little bit of a peripheral energy, but it's not like a pass-through. You know, for a woman with breast cancer, right? Yeah, you'll be cancer-free, but there's a chance that you'll develop heart disease because the pass-through radiation now has touched an artery in your heart. To me, that's unacceptable when other science exists. And a lot of people don't know about proton therapy because there's 1,400-plus traditional radiation places in the country, and there's 32 proton therapy places in the country. And then insurance is scared of it because it's been historically expensive to build these centers. But now I remember trying to save $1,000 for a VCR in the 80s. And then about 10 years later, you could buy them for 10 bucks, And so it just comes down to if you don't build it, you can't advance. And if you don't support the building of advancing technologies, then you're going to be stuck in the status quo. And to me, it's like circle slash. Status quo is unacceptable. We need to move past this. We're better. We've got supercomputers now. We're able to map the genome. We're able to figure things out that we never could figure out before. Let's take advantage of the technology that we've created, and let's save more lives and quality of lives.
And Scott Ault will just reinforce having now getting to know you better and partnering with Scott Cares. It's a phenomenal, amazing organization, and I want to encourage our audience, visit scottcares.org, read even more. And like you said, whether it's $1 or $1 million, click on that donate button because it's an opportunity to make a difference.
You know, it's like, it's so funny. I was sitting with a friend of mine and, you know, he was talking about somebody, you know, somebody handed him a dollar, you know, and said, this is for, you know, Rocket Town, I think it was.
Yeah.
And he goes, dollar. He goes, I was really touched. And I go, you know, a drop in the bucket is still more than was in that bucket before, you know, and, you know, whatever that is, you know, we all have to participate. And I think back on the New Testament, you know, where this lady came up and she gave everything she had. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jesus said, surely I tell you that her...
The woman at the well.
Yeah. Her gift is greater than all of yours, because that's all she had. And I think about that. And, you know, Carrie Morgan, who's my executive director, and Nancy Whitman and Nadia Kogler, that's basically, you know, our main staff, they're really... really tight with making sure that, you know, we're lean, we're mean, you know. Right now we're pretty much an event-based income company, but we really need to push people just believing in our mission and getting on board without having to be, you know, to put on a big event and to having to spend all those hours. It's a lot of work, and it's, you know, I'd rather put that money directly toward the research than towards, you know, supporting an event. You know, we're pretty responsible with those dollars as well, but you know, it's just, how do you build it? You know, you just need people to believe in what you're doing and jump on board, and then they get to take that victory lap when we find the answer to a cancer that probably directly affected them.
Yeah.
You know, my mother died of metastatic melanoma breast cancer, and I just, you know, I dream that one day they're getting better at it now. Back then it was just chemo. They're getting better at it now, and with immunotherapy, it's showing more promise than any other treatment. So I know we're right.
Yeah.
We just need more people to know about us and more people to get involved.
Good. Well, one last question, Scott, before we're out of time. And you mentioned up front how you're wearing Scott Cares Performance Moisture Wicking Polo by Authentically American.
It's really comfortable. It's awesome. No, but you know, it's great. You know, we hear so much and there's so many opinions about America First, you know. And it's like, you know, they tell us to put the mask on our face before that of our child, you know, on an airplane, because if we're no good, no one is. And if we spend all of our time just, you know, throwing everything out without shoring ourselves up first, I mean, man, it makes so much more sense to me for this country. If we want to be a leader in the world, to be able to be financially sound, for our people to be at work, for us to take, you know, real pride in what we're able to create and how we create it with our own workers that can support their own families and to give as they see fit. Yeah. If we got to put the mask on our faces first, and then we can, you know, that light will, you know, just shine on the world. But if we're constantly, if it's all just going out and our people are starving and our people aren't really... I love the idea of really just shoring ourselves up and just really, you know, being that light that we're meant to be in the world. You know, America is an experiment in so many ways, but it's also, it was created for all the right reasons. So it's, I love Authentically American. I love the fact that, you know, everything is here. It's right here. We're putting people to work and, you know, we're able to, you know, make our community stronger.
Love that, Scott, because for us, everything, no exceptions, is made in USA, but for us, it's even more than that. I mean, it's a way of life. It's the spirit in which, you know, we operate our company.
And I've met, you know, so many young entrepreneurs and older entrepreneurs as well. You know, when I look back on Stars and Ice, we were sponsored for so many years by Smucker's. Family-owned business. Mm-hmm. All they do is gobble up more businesses, you know, and they're very humble, you know. They're very much about where the, and I went for a tour in their factory one time, and it was then the happiest place to work.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, what does that take? And they go, we just we look after our own, and we're responsible with our money, and we pay people well, and we take care of their families, and we create a joyful environment. And that's for us, you know, whether it be the Skating Academy or for CARES, you know, we really want to create a destination. We want to make sure that everybody that comes on board is looked after, taken care of. Mm-hmm. They know that they're we're grateful and they're honored, you know, as part of our process. And again, it's just, how do we change the world?
Yeah, that's really kind of what we're after at Authentically American, that we don't work there. You know, we're pursuing a greater good. We've got that sense of direction, vision, purpose, you know, to make a difference. So one last thing, Scott, I have two gifts for you.
Oh, boy.
To join us here. One is a fun gift, and you are a great American, so socks are always fun.
Oh, I love socks. Yeah, I saw these on the website.
Yeah.
These are awesome.
So these are literally 100% made in America. They are Carolina cotton, knit and cotton. And then you can see we've got,
these
when you're
awesome.
More traditional conservative, you can go with the black or gray option. But when you really want to get wild and feel festive and patriotic.
Yeah, I'm a wild, festive guy.
Let's go.
Yeah.
So the last one.
Thank you so much.
Last gift we have is Authentically American Like You is all about giving back. So 10% of our revenue is donated to two veteran charities. One is the Folded Flag Foundation, who supports Gold Star families. The other one is Reboot Alliance, who supports not only veterans, but first responders with a faith-based PTSD program. So what we're going to do is we're going to make a donation on your behalf to both of those organizations.
Thank you so much. Wow. You know, it's mm-hmm. I'm one of those guys that thanks, you know, every time I walk by a policeman or a fireman or, you know, anyone in the armed services, I just thank them, because, you know, it's, we can just sort of, you know, kind of walk along through life and just ignore everything going on around us, or we can, you know, show our gratitude for the freedoms that we hold, for the fact that this really crazy social experiment that is America has become, you know, one of the most dynamic countries ever in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And it started, you know, basically as a place to freely practice your faith.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's, we can't ever take our eye off that. America was founded to freely practice our faith. And, you know, it's not about denying faith, you know. It's about really trying to understand what that is in our world and in our lives and in our families and our communities. And you know, I see a lot of people that have given up on it. It's sad, because to know that we're loved unconditionally, you know, forever.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the definition
for eternity.
The definition of the gospel, as I've been told, is you are loved, deal with it.
Pretty matter of fact, that's the way it is.
That's
whether
what
you like
you're
it
loved,
or not.
Deal with it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think so many people just give up. Mm-hmm. And we can't. We can't give up. We have to, you know, pursue each other. We have to pursue the Lord, and we've got to just, you know, put love first, put light first, and just chase out the darkness. And, you know, I really commend you for what you're doing, and, you know, especially for our service.
We're just getting started, Scott, and it's an honor.
I love that. We're just getting started.
Here it comes. Well, Scott, again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Awesome.
You've been listening to the Authentically American podcast. You can follow Authentically American on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and find all our episodes at authenticallyamerican.us/podcast. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Thank you for listening.